welcome to Oral Fixation, the podcast that is queer thinking and straight talking. Every episode, my best friend Andy and I take an album that means something to the queer community and discuss it in a way that is effervescent yet striking. This episode, we discuss Schizophonic by Jerry Halliwell, which was released in 1999 by EMI and Capitol Records. What you see ain't what you are getting. I am creasing. Drew, here we are, another episode of Queer Thinking and Straight Talking.
Well, there's just so much to say. I'm schwitzing.
We've been on this, let's say, Zoom call with our guest this episode for about 5 minutes, and I'm already laughing, and we haven't really even said anything. I just am preemptively laughing at the hoot that this episode will be. Our guest this episode, we are blessed to be joined by a bona fide, true blue, 90s pop groupie of dizzying heights I still can't comprehend, and I'm only halfway through his book. Welcome to Oral Fixation, Malcolm McLean.
Thank you. Hello. Hi, guys. Nice to speak to you today.
It's such a treat to speak to you. Of course, I already, even before we started recording, I already did the I'm Victoria Malcolm line on you. How many times a week do you get that as a huge Spice Girl stan?
I do get that all the time. You know that if someone's a true Spice Girl stan, yeah, if they come out with that, it's the test, really. Yeah, as soon as they hear my name, like, they either mention it or they don't. and you passed the test.
But what's your response?
You just lie there comatose like the boy in the movie.
Yeah. It's just the line itself that's iconic. Yeah, it's sad that there's no real response to it. But
for a while, yeah. I was considering having my drag name be Victoria Malcolm.
Victoria Malcolm. That would be really good. It's very niche.
It's very niche, but I don't reckon it would be taken. So if I do decide to get back into that corset, I know what I've got myself in for. But anyway, Malcolm, tell us a little bit about your work. And obviously, listeners would have seen that we're chatting about Jerry Halliwell. Well, Horner Ney Halliwell, I should say. And it would be great just to hear a little bit about what makes you more than qualified to have this discussion with us.
Well, basically, I mean, these days I just spend most of my time doing like a boring admin job in London. But when I was a teenager, I was an obsessive pop stalker, sort of between the years of Eternal and Hearsay, like the first UK TV pop stars band. And so I used to go and follow pop stars all over London and the country. And then a couple of years ago, I wrote a book about it.
And the book is called Freak Like Me, which is not only iconic, it's schizophrenic.
Yeah. I mean, if you're really pedantic, I have had big 90s pop fans come up to me and they say, I feel like you've named it after after the Sugar Babes song, which came out in 2002, but you know, it's a 90s pop book. And I always point out to them, like, yeah, but it is actually a 90s R&B song originally, so I just really, really wanted to get that title.
There you go. School the children, Malcolm.
Yes.
And so, Malcolm, obviously we want everyone to go out there and buy the book, but perhaps you can give us just a little taste of one of your favourite celeb stalking moments. And we're not condoning stalking here, listeners, but...
Oh, God. It's probably got to be a Jerry memory. I guess in the schizophrenic era, we used to go... Me and my friend used to go to her house a lot, as you do. But she would let us onto the driveway and occasionally into the garden. And once we went, so it was 99, we went, it was like her 27th birthday. We took a few gifts and balloons. One of the balloons came off the string and got stuck in her tree in her garden. And then she came out. There was a huge thunderstorm. And she gave me, in order to get dry, she gave me a towel from her house and a T-shirt to put on. And I had to get changed in front of her to put it on.
Gorgeous, very intimate.
It is quite intimate, and it's just, it's stranger than fiction.
That leads us very nicely into the album that we're discussing today, which is Jerry's Schizophonic, the first solo album to be released by a Spice Girl, and actually not our first solo Spice album that we're discussing on the pod, but definitely one that warrants discussion. So why is it that this album is so important to you as a queer person, Malcolm?
For me, I was, I think I was 15 when this album came out. Maybe like just about, yeah, turning 15, 16. And for me as like a young closet gay boy growing up in suburbia, it was, it felt pretty groundbreaking that such a huge, enormous mainstream star was it, the whole album was just so fabulous and fantastic and just really, really gay. It felt like she was openly kind of courting the gay market.
I mean, if you look at the entire campaign of Schizophonic, there are subtle little nuggets for the gay community, and then there are big, wide open yoo-hoos! I'm over here, gay community. Like if we look at the Bag It Up video, the pink hair, as you say, the cutout chaps. For me, I was a little bit younger than you when Schizophonic came out, but it definitely, and I hadn't reckoned with my own sexuality yet, but there were those sort of crumbs being left for me, and then just massive loaves of bread being hurled at me, and that was really exciting. And I actually only in doing the research for this episode realized that even one of the B-sides, I think it's the B-side to Mi Chica Latino, is literally called GAY, and that would have been, you know, it's a different, this is 20 years ago, it was a very different climate back then. And kind of radical that she did that, and obviously so clearly knew her audience. I do wonder if George Michael might have been in her ear a little bit about how useful the gay community would be to get on side. But I think that she was doing something really camp, really tongue-in-cheek, and to a certain degree, pretty credible as well. You know, she got 4 number ones with this album, and I think, look, sorry, 3 number ones with this album, and I think Look At Me was number 2.
Yeah, 3 number ones with this album, and then she had another one with the Absolutely Not Gay, It's Raining Men, for the follow-up.
Straight anthem. Yeah.
That was just
anthem.
a more of a subtle nod to the gay community.
It's pretty amazing, Malcolm. Like, I, like I said, I've only managed to get halfway through your book, and I've been familiar that this book, Freak Like Me, exists for a couple of years, but I've only just recently taken the plunge because I think I followed you on Instagram for a while, and I've been aware of this kind of this figure, this 90s pop groupie who's written these stories. But when we asked you to come on and you said that you wanted to do this album, you said something very interesting which I hadn't really clocked before, that you felt like, I'm paraphrasing you here, that Jerry's first solo album was effectively more true to the DNA of the Spice Girls than what the Spice Girls did themselves with the third album, Forever. And through researching this album and taking myself back 21 years to that, it just completely obsessed with every ounce of my being Spice fan, and all of the rollercoaster emotions and the devastation when Jerry left, and just the outright anger and upset at this like idol leaving this group. I went very much kind of stayed loyal to the Spice Girls and was like, no, they're my girls, they're sticking together. And I do have fun things to say about the Forever album, but I've got to say, on reflection and listening to this album, I don't think it's, you know, a masterpiece by any stretch, but I think you're right that it has the DNA of Spice running through it. In a really interesting way, that there's a couple of songs which are very, very Spice Girls, but as a whole, that there's nothing that really reaches those dizzying heights. And
no, I was just gonna say, I think she was doing that kind of classic thing of the late 90s, where I think, and you talked about it on your Mel C Northern Star podcast, where she just sort of takes, I'm going to try a bit of everything out. This kind of like pick and mix attitude to, like, I've just left a girl band, especially, I mean, I think albums were a little bit more like that back in the day, a bit less kind of cohesive. But definitely like, I don't really know who I am yet. I'm just going to try a bit of everything out. And it is this like very weird, sort of interesting mix of songs, but it's so, yeah, it's so knowingly camp. And yeah, I think almost maybe like a slight air of tragedy about it, because there is like with like a lot of things with Jerry. I mean, I absolutely adore her, but a slight sort of lack of self-awareness, where she's pretty shameless and she'll just, you know, absolutely try everything. But yeah, I think it has some of the energy that was missing, like the spice that the Forever album lacked when that came out. And I think it's, yeah, you can kind of imagine, like, if Schizophrenic had been all the kind of crazy, really camp and ridiculous elements of that had been injected into Forever, then maybe you would have had, like, the truer third album of the Spice Girls.
I think that's such a great point. And it felt to me I should say, before this episode, I'd only known the singles. I didn't know any of the album tracks, but a lot of them feel very much like kind of graduations of songs from Spice World. Like Walk Away begins in a very sort of similar way to Viva Forever. And Goodnight Kiss feels very similar to Too Much.
Oh, it's so and, Too Much, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and kind of, you know, but takes it to a new place. And it is actually so interesting now having this discussion around it being closer in DNA to, you know, what the Spice Girls' third album might have been like. It's so kind of wild and cool to me to think about this, you know, that the Spice Girls were never really greater than the sum of their own parts, you know? Like, no. The Spice Girls together were so strong, and then now with the solo albums, you kind of, it becomes a bit fractured and fragmented, but the sort of finding those flecks of what were part of that initial true Spice DNA is so interesting to me. It's really cool.
I think history, kind of, people have looked back on Ginger Spice, you know, until she left the group, and seen that because she was such a leader of the band, and she kind of, her energy, although she was just one part of it, she did really, I think she injected a lot of that sort of naff, completely over the top, like campness that it wasn't all of what the Spice Girls were about, but it was just such a big, you know, part of their energy. And I think she just, when she fled, she took a bit of it with her.
Yeah, you're right. Mal, can you say something in your book quite early on, which both Drew and I have said to each other and on this podcast, which, you know, Ginger Spice was quite possibly the first drag queen that I ever loved. And you say something also, and I know what you're saying with it, but you say, you know, you're not intending to insult anyone. And it's funny, like, I would just, there was a time that probably calling a woman a drag queen would have been an insult. And now it's certainly not, at least in our social circles. But that cartoon, all of the Spice Girls were cartoon characters, as we've said before, but Ginger Spice was the cartoon character, the bright red hair.
She was the exclamation mark on the sentence.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we can't speak for all gay Spice Girls fans, but I think generally speaking, the Spice Girl who spoke the most to young queer boys was Ginger. and there's reasons for that.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, obviously everyone has their own favourite and stuff, but there was something, yeah, it's, I wrote that in the book, I thought, oh, is some people going to think this is, yeah, this is really offensive, but I did mean it with love, and not just because I love drag queens, but it was, I don't know, it's just this, yeah, that kind of very, just over the top, but total, like, fearlessness about what people think of you, this, you know, Ginger Spice attitude. Like, she never, Jerry herself, you know, she talked over the years about, you know, she was never the greatest singer, and she wasn't classically trained, not the best dancer and stuff, but, you know, maybe dodgy fashion sense, but she just was like, I can do anything. And I think she just inspired a lot of queer people around the world, I think, with that kind of attitude.
That is precisely it. And when we hear drag queens talk about the strength and power that drag gives them, from what we know of Jerry now, before Spice Girls and certainly after, like you just said, what she said about herself, it's now clear that Ginger Spice was that shield, that drag, that armor, which allowed her to be that completely fearless individual who inspired queer people, like you said. But as a fan, like, I think that's probably what I've craved from her in the years that followed. And I do think that Ginger Spice died in 1998, 1999. And I don't think we've really ever seen Ginger Spice again. And that's actually okay, because, you know, that was possibly just a period and a phase in Jerry Halliwell's life. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think when we tie that back to queer people seeing themselves in that Ginger Spice fearlessness, there's always going to be something slightly melancholy about how we haven't seen her for a very long time and we're probably never going to see her again.
Yes, I know. Yeah, I agree with that. I think she, I do think she took it with her for this album. And although, I mean, she had It's Raining Men, that was maybe like the kind of swan song of the Ginger Spice era. But I think, yeah, this album was sort of the final time that maybe we saw that kind of energy. There were a few sort of little nuggets around, like, the kind of the later years of her solo career. But yeah, I think we won't see her again. But it was incredible at the time. I think 1997 Ginger Spice, you know, when I look at some of the costumes and things that she used to wear, it was just getting bigger and bigger and more ridiculous. Like going to, I think, what was it? The award show in America, dressed as Elvis and stuff. Everything she did just got camper and camper. It's just an incredible time, I think.
I would imagine that it was easier to push the boat out even further when you had four of your peers around you supporting you and acting as a kind of a nice, like, allowing you to have nuance and levels. And then when it was just her on her own, there are definitely those flecks of the essence of Ginger Spice in the album, you know, beginning a song with, ha 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 ha, it's important to laugh at yourself.
It's important to learn to laugh at ourselves.
It's very, very Ginger Spice to me. But I think that some of those elements just felt a little bit more jarring without the rest of the girls to kind of add other layers to it.
And I think that speaks directly, Drew, to the Spice Girls being far greater than the sum of their parts, even as five individual talented people, even as five people who had remarkable solo careers. Yes, even VB, we're including you in this. If you compare any of those five solo careers to pop stars today, the run of top five number one hits that they had in the UK is completely baffling on reflection when you look at the quality of the music. But they are talented. They're talented people. But nothing will ever come to the talent of the five together. And I think you just nailed it, Drew, with, you can just imagine these five, like, firecrackers together in a room, just completely surpassing themselves based on the confidence that they were getting from just being as part of that five. That maybe when they went off on their own individual paths, it was always maybe challenging to get that confidence and energy back.
And they were also so young, you know. You took her a balloon on her 27th birthday.
Yeah.
I mean, I think to myself, fuck, 27, what I would give to be 27 again. But that she was old. She was the Old Spice, you know? And they were all sort of flung into this crazy fame so young. It's a wonder. It really is a wonder that they all came out pretty much unscathed. They're all pretty well-rounded individuals. For the most part.
Yeah, I think they'd been through a lot, hadn't they, in those few years. I mean, it was like, there was such a short time, like kind of 2 years where Jerry was in the group and they, you know, and the group sort of existed in the charts, but it just felt so much longer than that. You know, they literally, in that time, they conquered the world, they met everyone, you know, like Nelson Mandela and stuff. Like, there was, when she released this album, she was still like one of the most famous women in the world. But she just was like, she just didn't really know what she wanted to do. I remember at the time, lots of people were, well, I remember the radio DJ, Dr. Fox on Capital London.
Oh my God, shout out to Dr. Fox.
he used to say, I think she should be, you know, when there were hints that she was recording an album, he was like, no, I think she should be a TV presenter. You know, that's where her strengths lie. I remember him saying something like that. And it was, but she was just like, she knew she didn't probably have all the musical abilities of all the others. But she was like, no, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make an album. This attitude of like, I totally believe in myself. I think some of the press was, you know, against her. I think like the 90s media was quite homophobic. There are parallels with the gay community. The 90s press were sort of quite anti-Jerry and the Spice Girls and wanting to kind of knock people down and sort of vilified her. And similar with how they treated the gay community back then. And she was sort of like I think she just really, really wanted to prove herself. And I think she kind of maybe had enough for this one big album. And then it kind of petered out beyond that.
Though that said, shout out to Scream If You Want to Go Faster.
Shout out to Ride It.
Oh God, you're the DJ, I'm the song. Now let's talk about the music. Malcolm, can you remember what you were doing when you first saw the funeral of Ginger Spice, actually, the Look At Me video?
Yeah, I think I remember like chasing pop bands around London in like early 99, and we'd like sort of thumb through the tabloids because we never bought anything, and we were like standing, you know, outside of WH Smith at a train station, and we were like, oh my God, they've got the stills from the music video they're gonna show it on Top of the Pops tomorrow night. And then I made sure that I was there at home, like glued to the screen, and they had this world exclusive where they just shut it. That's how big it was. They were like, okay, the record label have given us the video, we're just going to show it in the middle of Top of the Pops because this is how big this is.
Wow.
Getting to that scene, you know, there's like her with all the different characters walking around Prague just being like absolutely fabulous. I had heard the song earlier in that day, but it was just, it was insane, it was crazy. And then, you know, getting to that scene where Ginger has her funeral. I had one of my friends at the time, who I used to go and see them with, she was like a true Spice fan, whereas I was all about Jerry. And I just thought that was hilarious and like fantastic. I think it's quite funny that my friend, she was my age, but she was quite upset about that. And I wonder if that's how other Spice Girls fans were at home, like, oh God, she's killed off Ginger. Oh, it's really sad. And, you know, she's ditching it and stuff, but I just thought it was hilarious.
No, I can tap into that feeling right now of just feeling kind of like indignantly offended that this person who had dared to be such a hugely influential impact on me was now making light of it in a music video. Now, I obviously think it's the most camp, fantastic, fabulous thing. And it's actually very, I think Look At Me and to a degree the wider album, but Look At Me especially is a love letter to two of Jerry's biggest idols, I do think. And I think the funeral of Ginger Spice is very George Michael playing. The opening bars, well, the chorus of Freedom, when he went solo after Wham with Faith. Now, I would have loved it if she had. I don't know if she could have for copyright reasons, but if she'd included, like, I don't know, some kind of organ Spice Girls chorus at the beginning of Look At Me, that would have been fierce. But I think that was her shout out to George. But also acknowledging the elephant in the room, I do think I've got to just crack open the Immaculate section and say that I do think Jerry, like Melanie C, was profoundly shaped by her, you know, adoration of Madonna in her first steps in her solo career, and where Mal C literally just went and worked with Madonna's songwriters and producers from the time. I think Madonna shines through in Jerry's like audacity and the visuals and the campness. Look At Me, and maybe more like, maybe Bag It Up more so later, but I see like Express Yourself, and I see elements of Vogue.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely through lines with Machica Latina as well, but yes.
But yeah, the funeral. Look at, and she's stunning in the Look At Me video. She looks absolutely gorgeous as she plays those different characters, those different reinventions. She looks absolutely stunning. And I still think that's a banger. I remember hearing that a few years ago in a club in Melbourne, and it went off. And I opened with, when I first heard it playing...
Was it a gay club?
It was a gay club. It was actually called Thursgay. It's called Thursgay. Shout out to Thursgay. But just like I can tap into my 90s obsession with the Spice Girls, I can also tap into my early 2000s. And I don't know if you felt this, Malcolm, or even you, Drew, but I can also tap into my kind of embarrassment at being a Spice fan. I felt like there was that period between Spice peak and then them kind of coming back round again with their first reunion in 2007, where it was kind of embarrassing to talk about how much you love the Spice Girls. And now there's no embarrassment at all because we've moved through that kind of awkward stage. But
no, I know what you mean. There was a definite lull when the noughties really got going, and you know, fashion had changed. The 90s were so not in. It was like, are you like a skinny indie guy, you know, like just recording, you know, guitar music or whatever, or you're on reality TV, and everything to do with the Spice Girls was, yeah, it was a bit, it was quite uncool, and it was forgotten about, yeah.
And so, sorry, I've just remembered why I even mentioned that. It's because when I heard the opening of Look At Me on that dance floor, I thought, oh my God, banger. And then I thought, oh no, everyone's going to think this is really embarrassing if I dance to it. But the floor exploded and people loved it.
Yeah, no, I think, and that song was like a bit of a, like a desperate plea for attention at the time from her, like the title and everything about it. It was like screaming, you know, look at me. And I think she definitely got the message over. I do think it's quite interesting that radio shunned it at the time as well. Yeah, they wouldn't really play it because it was just, you know, it's ridiculous. But yeah, like it's I think it's really amazing that she, you know, she felt, I think she felt quite devastated that it didn't, she just missed out on the number one for it.
Well, shout out to deep enemies of the pod, Boyzone. Yeah. Louis Walsh back at his shit once again. And I actually, I'm going to shout out, I'm not sure if you, Malcolm, are aware of, it's a UK-based pop music, 2000s pop music podcast called Right Back At Ya. Shout out to Right Back At Ya. I was listening to, they've got an episode on the solo Spice singles between, I think, 2000 and 2002 or something. And I didn't realize this, but I found out that Boyzone was so worried. I mean, Boyzone's management was so worried that Jerry was going to take the top spot that they decided to release two versions of their single. I think, was it You Needed Me?
It was, it was You Needed Me, I think. Yeah, yeah, it's kind of forgettable.
And they were both exactly the same. They just had different cover artwork. And the idea was that fans would buy both because they wanted to have this as a sort of collector's item. And they didn't beat her by that much. I think it was only...
I looked it up. Yeah, was it like someone... was it 700 copies or something? It was really, a really, really small amount. Yeah, she was absolutely livid. And I do think she made sure that she never made that same mistake again for the rest of the album. She was like, I'm going to push the boundaries. I'm going to use my marketing genius and make sure that I nail every single song. Doesn't matter if it's not the biggest song in the world. I'm going to get a number one with it by her, the Ginger Spice attitude.
How did Bag It Up get to number one? How did even Machico Latina get to number one? I love these songs. I love them. I'm not knocking them, but how did they get to number one in the UK? It is remarkable.
Yeah, I think they are big pop tunes. And I think it's interesting that you picked those two, because for me, Lift Me Up is the one that I hear. And even at the time, I was like, this is a mid-tempo kind of trying to be Karen Carpenter song, like, you know, but sounding a bit like a Karen at karaoke, like, and it just, and but it got to number one, but that was because of, you know, the chart battle and her making it into.
And Lift Me Up, I think, was also that first glimpse of that kind of like painfully earnest Jerry, maybe lacking a bit of that self-awareness, which we've come to kind of cringe and love, where it's like, Jerry, I just don't think this ballad is this remarkable masterpiece that you're selling it to us as. But then, to be fair to her, it did go to number one.
Jerry is so interesting to me. I honestly, what I would not give to sit in a room with Jerry and a therapist and just hear the conversation. But she is a smart cookie. And if you look at what was going on in music around that time, Spanish, there was you had Ricky Martin, you had J-Lo that was exploding. The year after that you had Shakira. Like, a lot of South American and Spanish inspired music, Latin inspired music, was making big waves in the charts. And I think that she, I don't think it was a, I refuse to believe that it's a fluke that she released that song and it got to number one, because it's so of the time, and it was tapping into this trend that hadn't become passé yet. It was only just beginning to bubble, and she identified that and went with it. And I've got to give her props for that.
I think it is a phenomenal, like, pop song. I do think that is probably the best single of her solo career. But it's, you know, her mother's Spanish, and, you know, she used to say in interviews, oh, I got my mum to help me out with, you know, some of the language on it and stuff. I do think it's kind of full of cliches in a way that, you know, when Little Mix or, you know, Justin Bieber and people, even Kylie, like, kind of have Spanish tinged songs now, it's not quite done in the same way that Jerry did it. I think it's my boyfriend. He said it was like the musical equivalent of an all-inclusive package holiday to Benidorm.
Iconic. Malcolm, Drew definitely knows this story. I don't know if you know it, because I can't remember. I genuinely can't remember whether I mentioned it on the Spice Girls episode or not. But Machico Latino holds a very special place in my heart, because I specifically, and just a disclaimer, in 1999, I would have been 8, I think, or was it 2000, whatever, around that age. No excuse to my actions, but just to give some perspective here, I remember getting the Schizophonic album, devouring it, loving it, playing around with the kind of angel versus devil liner notes, just listening to every single song. And this was pre Machico Latino's single release. And I, I didn't even know it would be a single. I took it upon myself to write down the lyrics from the liner notes and take them into school and tell these girls that I was friends with in the playground, who I just, like, make up dance routines within the playground. I was like, girls, I've written this new song. It's called Machico Latino.
That's your Ginger Spice business acumen coming out there. And a slight lack of self-awareness.
Yeah. Yes! Yeah, well, you say lack of self-awareness, but they fucking lapped it up. They ate it up. They couldn't believe that I'd written a song that great. And I performed it to them. They were like, I can't believe you've written this. And we made up a dance routine to it. I vividly remember, as in this kind of four square, making up this song and like kind of reading out the lyrics, the tragedy of it all, I can't comprehend. But then when the single actually came out, we just didn't talk about it. We did not talk about it. And whether those girls were just saving me the sheer embarrassment, no one discussed that. And I think I actually erased that memory from my brain for years. Like, I just did not even think about it. I refused to acknowledge how embarrassing that entire event was. It's only in recent years that I've kind of faced it head on. But Machica Latino for me will always be the song that I deluded myself into thinking I wrote.
The Ginger Spice Attitude.
It's iconic. It's schizophrenic. Speaking of that album artwork, I've got to say, there was something going on in the late 90s, early 2000s with this whole devil, angel, two different sort of split versions of yourself thing. I actually think, because if you look, for listeners that don't know, the Schizophrenic album had the main cover, which I always thought kind of looked a bit like Jerry was in a straitjacket. Or is she in a straitjacket?
I never got straitjacket vibes from it, to be honest. But I know it's called Schizophrenic. And well, I think she wanted to call it Schizophrenic originally. I'm sure I remember seeing an interview where she was like, went into a label meeting and said, I'm going to call it Schizophrenic. And they said, I don't know if you can do that. But the 90s kind of, you know, we'll meet in the middle version of that was, we'll call it Schizophrenic.
Schizophrenic. It's a perfect album name because she's very sort of cerebral, sometimes to the point of nausea. She's all over the place.
Yeah.
You know? And it's trying out different styles and it's something that you listen to. But the album artwork is sort of the lead album artwork is the soft white sort of angel version. And then in the inlet or whatever, there's a devil's version where she's sort of all in red and what have you where the O in the first version has a halo, the O in the second version has devil horns. And it's all just very that, which I love. And I also love that the songs on the back, there's 10 songs and 5 of them are in white and 5 of them are in red. And it's almost like these are the sort of more naughty, devilish songs. And these are the more sort of chilled, calm songs, which I love. But I also find it so interesting to directly compare that with the Holler and Let Love Lead the Way videos that came out not long after, which were also sort of showing each of the Spice Girls. They both played into the four elements, so fire, yeah, earth, air, and water. And in the different videos, a different Spice Girl had a different one. But they were also sort of showing the duality of each of those Spice characters that we sort of had come to know. And I think that that's interesting if you observe the fact that each of these women had been told and had been projected as this one thing. Like, this is the posh one, this is the scary one, this is the baby one, this is the sporty one, and this is the ginger one, but the effervescent, yeah, crazy one. Like, I think that both of those campaigns were wrapped up in showing a bit more duality and a bit more sort of, not necessarily duplicity, but more levels to each of the characters so that they could, whether they were still together or on their own, in order to evolve a bit more.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, where they've been, you know, in a girl band which was basically aimed at children, you know, for years. Obviously the rest of the world loved them as well. But yeah, it was kind of, yeah, they've been told to sort of this is stay in your box. This is what you are. And when they were releasing solo material, each of them was wanting to show off a little bit more. Like, okay, I can bang out some like amazing pop hits, but I'm also gonna, you know, lie seductively on a piano and sing a jazzy number, and you know, and have the lights turned down red and. And I think, yeah, there was lots of people around the time who were people used to get in the late 90s. You know, they were like, devil and angel tattoos and stuff. And it's so of the era, isn't it? The kind of that concept.
And well, actually, wasn't I'm trying to remember. I haven't seen the video in ages, but wasn't Victoria Beckham's Not Such an Innocent Girl. Wasn't that, again, kind of like...
Yes.
She was in black and white.
Yeah, like a good girl and a bad girl. Yeah.
Boys, I'm sure, no doubt you both remember, the queerest touch point of this entire campaign for me is the 2000 Brit Awards, where in one award ceremony we had, at the end, the Spice Girls quite rightly deserving, you know, their outstanding contribution to music award. They did that medley. Will Smith gave them the award. It was all very random, but also very that. But earlier on in the show, Jerry had burst forth from inflatable legs from this musical vagina, surrounded by this army of buff muscle Marys performing, you know, Bag It Up. And I just remember at the time being baffled by the dichotomy of, like, in that arena at that time, all five Spice Girls are actually there together. However, the four of them...
It's Shakespearean.
It's very Shakespearean. The four of them are receiving this award. Jerry should have been up there with them, but, you know, she was actually... I can't resent her for it, because she was performing this, like, statement, this declaration of independence, that she was this new, her own pop star. Yes, again, taking shreds from, like, Madonna and George Michael, but putting forth this new Jerry Halliwell. And on reflection, you know, it kind of made me think, oh, is it a bit, you know, tragic that the Spice Girls aren't doing something similar, that they're sticking together? But, like, my loyalty always, like, kind of kept me with them. I was your friend, Malcolm, who was the Spice fan versus the Jerry fan after it. But it is Shakespearean, Drew.
Yeah, because the music video, to Bag It Up, like, Bag It Up was what, the fourth single from the album. You know, anyone who really wants Bag It Up has already got it on a CD. You know, she kept producing, like, some really fun B-sides for the singles to keep the energy going and stuff, and the sales up. But I think, yeah, when the Bag It Up video came out, it was like maybe the most Ginger Spice, it's the most Ginger Spice sort of song on the album. And the video, you know, with, like, you know, the guy's hair turns pink, there's tap dancing, there's male bunny rabbits, male sex slaves, it's like, let's just do everything. And it's,
I mean,
just
who's
extreme.
Wearing the trousers now?
Yeah, who's wearing the trousers now, walking over the men. It was brilliant. And yet, it almost, like, the music video has, as crazy and fantastic and camp as it is, has been eclipsed by the Brit's performance of the song, where she, you know, came out, you know, pole dancing out of the vagina and a big pair of legs and stuff. It was, like, even more fantastically camp and, like, screaming, look at me. Yeah, I loved it.
I think that is... It goes back to what we were saying earlier about, you know, the audacity of coming out with the first song from your solo album campaign, having been in arguably the biggest girl band in history, and being known for being outspoken and being a little bit over the top, and not shying away from that, and having your first single literally be called Look At Me, and then showing, you know, a little bit of range when it comes to Mi Chica Latino, which was, I guess, sort of a bit mid-tempo, but very sort of sexy, and then Lift Me Up, which was a bit more understated, and then Bag It Up just being this huge gay pride parade on stage at the biggest British music platform, when your ex-colleagues are about to get an award for how great they've been, that you were a fifth of contributing towards. It's just, I look at the younger version of myself seeing that performance on screen and feeling seen and represented without even knowing why, because it was just so unapologetic. And she was, I mean, she's literally, it's in the lyrics, you're in control. She was so powerful in that moment. And it would have been, I say it would have been easy for her to shy away from it, but she would never have shied away from it, because that's not who she is. And that, I think, is why it's that essence that, while it's not necessarily Ginger Spice, it sort of translated into her career as Jerry. That attitude, that stick-with-itness, that chutzpah, that's the thing that doesn't exist anymore. And that's why when I see Jerry on Drag Race being sort of a bit meek and a bit calm and sedated, that annoys me. Because I'm like, you don't have to be the person that you were 15 years ago. You don't have to. But there was a power in what you used to do. And now you're just this like chilled out, like, I don't know, like Formula One wife.
Yeah, I mean, she is who she is now. I feel like I've sort of made my peace with it. Even, I think, before the recent kind of years, the recent era, you know, Lady Geraldine Horner of the Manor, like, I either dressed in white or dressed in the, you know, the country Cotswolds, yeah, outfit. But, yeah, I think... yeah, there's something sad about you know, when she was on Drag Race. You know, it's like, oh, I'm just glad that you didn't resort to you know, swearing or things like that. It doesn't have that the old essence of Jerry, which I think is, yeah, it's slightly sad. But she seems happy now, and you know, she's married with children on her farm, and yeah. There was a quote that I put, well, it's in the book, but it's a quote from like the Molly Dineen documentary in 1999 when Jerry left the band. And it was, I think it was towards the end of it, and she was giving her kind of, you know, commentary on Jerry's life, and she'd been following her round, and she seemed quite unhappy and unsure of who she is. This is kind of just before the schizophrenic era, you know, took off with the promo for the album. And she said, she says in it, I think Jerry would maybe be happier living on a farm, married with a couple of kids and some animals, but that's never going to happen, is it? And I remember, I think I watched it back, like, while I was writing the book, I was like, this is crazy. This is who she is now. And she's sort of loving it, but...
And if she is happier, Malcolm, like you said, that is kind of the main thing. And there's no further discussion to that point, I guess. It's just always going to have this impact to us as those young queer boys who grow up with that icon before our eyes and that strength and power that it made us feel. It's always going to kind of leave that impact as we grow older. But
I think the only thing I'll add is that I think the reason that I feel incensed by it is because the essence of Ginger Spice still lives in me. And it still lives in so many of the other young boys that she inspired. And so for it to still be this fire that's burning inside me, and you know, as a queer person who is often set aside or, you know, feels like they don't have a voice or feels in some way subjugated, that fire that she lit inside so many of us when we were younger often fuels us. And so to see that person that set that spark within us not have it within themselves anymore, it feels a bit sort of, I don't know, like I'm out in the world on my own.
Yeah.
But that's probably something I should work through with my therapist.
You work through that with yeah, in your sessions. But it does, it's worth mentioning though that, you know, if someone is looking for that modern day contemporary Spice DNA. Now, I wasn't at the 2019 concerts. Drew, you were. Malcolm, I'm sure you were. But I can speak for the 2007 reunion tour. And I remember, you know, kind of being in awe that the Spice Girls carrying the flame for that Spice DNA, that quintessential girl power, both in like their dedication to it, the energy they're giving, are the two Mals. And that's what I've also seen in the videos for the 2019 tour, that Mal B and Mal C have never, like, when they're on stage together, they are those kind of ultra versions of their younger Spice selves and incredible performers. But whereas you kind of see the Ginger and, I guess, Baby to a degree, that their flame seems somewhat diminished, fair enough, they're like 25 years older, Mal C and Mal B still bloody give it, and they give it large.
Yeah, Yeah, I know. Yeah, you see kind of like, it's either sort of flex of, you know, the old Spice Girl personas throughout their kind of, I don't know, interviews or performances and stuff. And then when they're on stage like that, it feels like they really bring that old energy, you know, okay, I'm going to do it for the night. And it's, you know, this is what the fans want to see, because they were in my eyes, the Spice Girls, they were characters. And when they go on stage, the fans kind of, they want to see the character as well as, you know, them as people. But it's definitely, you know, they were unlike other pop bands, you know, back then. They really were these individual caricatures, yeah. And it's lovely to see, like, when they come on stage now, that they still bring that kind of energy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there was an electric energy. When I saw them in 2019, it was palpable. It was incredible. It was obviously a shame that Victoria wasn't there, but she was never going to be there. But her spirit was definitely felt. And it was just...
She was on the t-shirts and she took 20% of the merchandise fee. So, yeah. Malcolm or Drew, I've got a heap of things that I want to ask Malcolm about his 90s groupie dalliances. But is there anything else either of you want to say about Jerry or Schizophonic?
Well, I thought it might be worth... I mean, we haven't spoken at all about the album tracks, really. It's a 10-track album. So, you know, there's not much room for bumpf, but there's some bumpf in this album. I did like the brimful of Asher-ness of Let Me Love You. I don't know if an artist like Jerry would make a song like that today, considering the sonic inspirations, but I did think it was fun. And I also was intrigued by the daddy issue.
No, I know, I think exactly the same.
Well, her dad died really young, so...
I wouldn't be able to sympathise with that, I don't think.
I think, my kind of thoughts on the album, I totally agree. I think, to me, there's like the big pop hits and the, you know, the big numbers that are on there, which Jerry does so well. And I think everyone, you know, just thinks, oh, these are, you know... These are fantastic pop songs. And there's the other ones which, you know, I think they don't quite shine as bright, and they're not as sort of fully formed or fantastic as the others. What I actually love about Schizophonic is kind of, I think I view it all as like an era rather than just the album, because even I actually think the B-sides for the singles were some of the most fun moments that were from that era, and they were sort of missing from the album. Like, so there was the one that we talked about earlier, like with the song GAY, which she did as the B-side to Machica Latino, and it was like, you know, this ridiculous, like, you know, unembarrassed nod at the gay community. I think she only performed it once, which was when Bag It Up came out, and she did her second big show there, and she came on, and it was like it was the encore song, which is fantastic. And, you know, her and her dancers came on, they all had these t-shirts on that I were either, you know, either said GA or Y. And they were doing like a sort of YMCA dance to it, but doing G, A, and Y. Like, and then her dancers just sprayed everyone with like silly string. That's how ridiculous the ending of the show was. But it was fantastic, you know. And then so it's like, yeah, G, A, Y was one of the B-sides. And then for Lift Me Up, like Live and Let Die, and which... You know, for sort of an ex Spice Girl to take on like a Bond song, and just like, yeah, this is what I want to do as a B side, is, I think that's like quite a brilliant moment of the era. And then even so Bag It Up B sides, These Boots Were Made for Walking, Nancy Sinatra, and perhaps by Doris Day. They're so camp and brilliant, and I in hindsight, I think it's a shame that they're kind of missing from the album. You don't want it to just be an album of covers, but it's the album is the thing that you revisit easiest from that era, you know, like to tap into. And I think maybe there should be like a special edition that, you know, you can listen to and now, like, you know, on streaming or whatever, that has all those elements in, which I think really sort of encapsulate the campness of that era of hers. Yeah.
And we'll create an accompanying playlist for the episode with all of those B-sides on it.
Yes, yes. Yeah, you got to do it.
Malcolm, I want to ask you, I want to talk to you about Eternal, because you open Freak Like Me with, you know, the first few chapters kind of go to at length of your devotion to the iconic early to mid UK girl band, early to mid 90s UK girl band Eternal. And I just think I was a little, I just missed the boat on Eternal. I love Angel of Mine. I was fully aware that kind of Louise pissed off and did her own thing, but you are that Eternal Louise stan. Can you tell us a bit more about Eternal? I just need to know.
They were the band for me, you know, like for your era, it was like, you know, the Spice Girls, they shouted out to you and you know, I don't know, loved their energy and you know, the amazing pop songs that they were creating. I think for me, just being that little bit older, for me, it was like my kind of coming of age pop band that just got me into all of it was, yeah, we're Eternal. And they didn't have the same energy of the Spice Girls, but it was, you know, when my sister bought me, because I was a bit too young for the first album, so I kind of missed the era with Louise, even though it's my favourite Eternal era now. My sister bought me the single for Power of a Woman, which was them, you know, strutting around a, you know, a corridor in like PVC and, you know, huge heels and stuff, like bouncing hair, and it was. There's something about the energy of Power of a Woman. Obviously, it's, you know, girl power arrived the following year with this, you know, the Spice Girl slogan. But yeah, they were that band for me where they had the pop hits and they were stunning. I think Kelly and Louise were the really charismatic ones. The sisters kind of brought the more soulful energy. They were that band for me that I just fell in love with and sort of got so deep into them and, you know, just pop music in general and never looked back, really.
The whole thing has just been fascinating, and there are moments I genuinely am just sat there in bed reading it and I'm bursting out laughing. The way that you write, without blowing too much smoke at your ass, just completely nails, like, you speak to, you know, the young queer kids or like the outcasts of that era where, you know, you kind of poignantly tie in the experiences you were going through at school, which I think any queer kid of that era and later and definitely earlier can empathize with, and finding that escape in this tribe of people who you'd found, like this group of misfits who you would do the most incredible things with. Like you mentioned earlier, you know, you kind of stalk these pop stars, but I think the most incredible thing is how often you would go to bloody Top of the Pops. Like that is actually, to even go to Top of the Pops once and be in the audience is like the dream of any 90s kid obsessed with music, and you were there every week. What the fuck?
Yeah, it was like, it was just within reach. It wasn't even on like the side of London that I lived on, like, you know, out the other side in suburbia, but I just like, I made that trek across London and all the tubes and trains, like after school, in my, well, sort of second and my second to last and final year of school, where I just would, yeah, I'd do that on a Thursday, and all, you know, loads of the kids from our school, I mean, they I was quite heavily bullied and stuff. I didn't have loads of friends at school, which is also one of the reasons why I kind of turned so much to pop music as my solace. But yeah, I would get on the platform and some of the kids would be going home and, you know, they all knew that where I was going, oh, they're going to Top of the Pops. Oh, who's on this week? And I'd list all the people that I'd found out were playing because I had the number for the security gate and, you know.
This is pre-social media. This is pre any of that.
Yeah, there was a lot of groundwork that needed doing just to follow pop bands back in the day. Ringing up hotels and looking up things on like my, you know, pocket atlas and all these kind of things from my parents' landline that you couldn't really...
That's what I was going to ask. Your parents, what was... How did they feel about all this? Were they just like, let him do it, it's Malcolm? Were they like, can you please stop running up a phone bill?
Yeah, well, I used to ring the, you know, the airlines, to find out, you know, when I needed to be at Heathrow or Gatwick to see the stars jet off and, you know, hotels or whatever. I mean, God, there's so much that we used to do. And I don't know why... I mean, my parents, even before I actually started writing the book a few years ago, I remember us sort of joking about it. You know, I'd get a bit pissed at a family reunion or whatever, and I would be telling some stories. And my mum and dad were kind of reflecting on it, like, yeah, why did we let you do all this stuff at this age? And I think I think it's amazing that they let me do it. Maybe they should have reined me in a little bit. But I do think it's because I was so unhappy at school and had been, bullied because of, like, my perceived sexuality at the time. And my parents, they saw this kind of the passion and, like, just pure energy and love that I had for, like, 90s pop music. And I think they just thought, you know what, there's worse things he could be into. He seems to have found his, you know, tribe elsewhere. You know, as long as he's not hurting anyone, we'll let him do that, you know, because he doesn't have that, you know, he is bullied at so much at school. Yeah. I think that's the reason.
And I think you said something so beautiful just then, Malcolm, that I wonder might actually be one of the reasons that Andy and I started this podcast, which was, pop music is my solace. And yeah. I think that that is just so beautiful and lovely and true for certainly me and Andy, and I imagine a lot of people that listen to this as well.
Mm. And the way that you've described your kind of parents observing that and seeing what makes you happy and just kind of turning a blind eye because they're seeing the passion that their child is getting, I can't help but be reminded of, well, it brings it back full circle to the topic of this episode, which really is Jerry and Ginger Spice. And, I vividly remember, you know, sometimes feeling the shame of other people, maybe, you know, of loving the Spice Girls so much and being this flamboyant camp young boy. And I remember once, you know, putting on my cousin's high heels at a Christmas party and tripping down the stairs. And, like, you know, my auntie taking me to A&E and the doctor being like, what were you doing? And I was like, I was trying to be a Spice Boy. And honestly, like, on reflection, how embarrassing. But, you know, it was Christmas 1997. And the only thing I wanted that Christmas was a Ginger Spice doll. And in the run-up, I kept saying, this is what I wanted from Santa. This is what I wanted. And I remember my mum being a bit like, look, I just don't think you're going to get it. So don't get your hopes up. And me kind of feeling, you know, subconsciously from her, this like, I don't think she wants me to have this or whatever. I'm not imprinting. She's not here. She's not a guest on the line, but you're picking up what I'm putting down. Maybe there was a reluctance to buy your 7-year-old, clearly different son, a Ginger Spice doll. But I tell you what, on Christmas Day, we're unwrapping the presents and Jerry isn't in the bag. There's no Ginger Spice in the bag. And I remember thinking, okay, pretty gutted, pretty devastated, but there's some There's some amazing gifts in here. I can't be an ungrateful little shit. So I'm going to be happy with what I've got. And I tell you what, I remember my dad in the kitchen saying, this is so funny now, my dad saying, oh my gosh, what's that on the grass out there? Come and have a look. And I walked through to the kitchen. And my mum said, oh, that's something that must have fallen out of Santa's sleigh. And in on the lawn was a wrapped up box, the shape and size of a ginger spice doll. And I unwrapped it and there it was. And I will never forget that moment. I will never forget it. And even if that was their way of kind of giving me, like, not necessarily endorsing giving a little boy a doll, but knowing how happy I would be and how desperately I wanted it, I just think that's beautiful for parents in the 90s, which was a very different time to now, kind of looking at their kids who were a bit different and thinking, look, there's some small wins that we can do here to keep them happy.
It's also incredibly creative of them to come up with that narrative and abscond them from endorsing the gift that you so wanted, but also finding a way to give it to you. And in that same moment, creating all of this magic around it. It's just such a beautiful story. I love that. I love it. Shout out to Trish and Steve.
Malcolm, the only person I want to ask you about is Mylene Klass. Her mum gave you 5 bars of chocolate.
Yes, she did. Yeah. Yeah. Her mum, Bong, her name is Bong Klass. Amazing. And yeah, she, the last pop band that I was, pop stalking / following around the country was Hearsay. I guess I was, looking back now, I think I was probably slightly too old for it then. But also I really didn't want to let go of it because I was having so much fun. And I was at the age where I kind of was allowed to do even more things that I wasn't allowed to do when I was 15, you know, and going to see everyone here, there and everywhere. And I was like, okay, I've got slightly more money now with my admin job that I'm doing. And yeah, I could go and see a new band. So I followed Hearsay around for a bit. And it was when they were on their one and only UK tour, UK arena tour. It was in Manchester. I think, one of the last shows of the tour, and they had the after show party the night before. Me and my friends, we stayed at the hotel where it was going to be, found out, and it was like, yeah, we went to bed about 5 a.m. and the band did as well, like bought Suzanne a shot, you know, because it was her, I think it was maybe her 20th or 21st birthday or something. And Suzanne Shaw. And then in the morning, we came downstairs with our hangovers. We thought we were like fairly early, so we could see the band leave and just get on the tour bus and, you know, just get one last, hug or whatever, chat from them. And the band had already gone. And I found out, you know, I don't know, I was talking to like one of their crew that still hadn't left. But Mylene's mum and dad were standing there like with gifts, just waiting for the band. And my friends were like, oh, you know, she's your favourite. Go and tell her parents that they've already gone. So I had to, you know, I went up to them and said, oh, hi, you know, I'm Malcolm, blah, blah, blah. I'm really sorry to let you know, but the band, your daughter's already left. And it was really, it's something really sad about the fact that they, you know, being in a pop band at the time, it's like, you know, she didn't even realise that her daughter had left and, you know, she was being whisked away to do something else by then. And so I broke it to her, and she had these 5 bars of luxury chocolate that she bought from the gift shop of, you know, the Lowry Hotel. And she looked so sad, and she said, do you know what? You know, if I can't give these 5 bars of chocolate to the band, I want you to have them. And I know that you'll cherish them. And I was like, oh, that's really sweet. Also totally random and lovely, lovely tale. And I still got the bars of chocolate, which is probably...
No, you
weird.
Haven't.
Yeah, I have.
You're lying. That's
no, they are. They're in the box of my, like, you know, memorabilia that you... I think it was in my mum and dad's loft for years. And it's...
Box? Surely you have a shipping container or something.
It's not just the one box. There's a lot of them.
A shipping container with Holly Valance just saying.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, treasures in there. There's, you know, when some of my friends have looked through it, and you know, there's like, oh, look at these signed CDs and tour programs and stuff, and then they'll be like, what's this mouldy chocolate in this bag, or what's this like crushed up polystyrene cup? It's like crushed up polystyrene cup, and they're like, why would anyone keep that? I'm like, oh, that's when we got on All Saints tour bus and we helped ourselves to some of the food and drinks, and we took the polystyrene cup with us.
And that stuff, correct me if I'm wrong, Malcolm, but that stuff could just never happen now. Getting on a band's tour bus and helping yourself to their drinks just would not happen now, surely.
No, and at the time, I think we thought we'd like pushed it too far, and like we'd met them quite a few times, so we knew like their manager and stuff. But even he looked like he was gonna like burst into flames when he saw us like we're literally eating crisps and helping ourselves to like cans of Coke with our feet on the, you know, the seats and stuff on their tour bus.
What would Chasney think?
Well, like he saw the funny side and told us to get off or whatever. But I think nowadays it'd be like, this is a huge security alert. Like, how did this happen? Yeah, I don't know. They just they thought it was funny back in the day. But I'm sure that we were an absolute pain in the ass.
They know where it was at. Yeah, Malcolm, this has just been I feel like we've only just begun to scratch the surface. I want to know more about this sort of stalking. Sounds like you'd make an amazing private investigator, detective, finding out, calling up the Langham, finding out the airport details, getting the flight numbers. But we do have to wrap up. Where can people find you? And more importantly, plug your book, tell us everything, give us all of your details.
So the book is called Freak Like Me, Confessions of a 90s Pop Groupie. It's just like available on Amazon or other online retailers. And I've got a book Instagram, which is Freak Like Me Book, where it's just got, I've just put all of my like pictures and videos of, you know, all this kind of either, you know, amazing gems, signed stuff, or like total crap from back in the day, and it's all on there, which kind of
the polystyrene cups.
Yeah, the polystyrene cups, and party bags from, you know, Jerry's birthday party or whatever. But there's a load of stuff on there and pictures, which, so if you know, when people have read the book, I still get lovely messages from people like every few weeks, even though, yeah, it came out a while ago. But yeah, just from, you know, random people, a lot of gay people who've read the book and really connected with it. That's that whole thing of, you know, I was a you know, a bit of an outcast back in the day, and I turned to pop music, and sort of like finding themselves through that. And I love getting messages like that from people. Like, it never ever gets boring. But or just people who've just found the book really funny or something. It just, yeah, it's so nice hearing stuff like that. But yeah, I've got that, you know, that kind of stuff's online.
Incredible. And Andy, where can people find us?
People can find us at Oral Fixation Podcast on Instagram. They can find us at Oral Fix Pod on Twitter, which is much less frequently posted on, but it remains queer nonetheless.
And that's what makes it queer.
Yes.
You know, yes. It doesn't need to.
For some baffling reason, we're still on Facebook, but I think the whole, you know, we're all going to switch that off at some point soon. And we're going to enter the metaverse. We're going meta. People can email us at oralfixationpodcast@gmail.com. They can find Drew at With All Drew Respect. Where can they find me?
They can find Andy Leave Andy on the corner of Hollywood and Vine. No, they can find Andy at, and well, shout out to the iconic Spice reference that is Andrew, do you think you are? Written as I've been led to understand by Jerry. She does say in Spice World, the movie, we wrote this song. I take that with a pinch of salt, but you can follow Andy at Andrew, do you think you are?
Now, we don't question the songwriting talent of the Spice Girls. That's one thing we don't joke about.
VB was always in the room. The most important thing, though, is to subscribe, leave a review, leave a rating. It helps people find us easier, and it also makes our egos feel a little bit more fulfilled.
Yeah.
Yeah. Malcolm, thank you again so much, and I am gonna just relax now with the rest of this bottle of wine that I've got, and I'm gonna listen to Mi Chico Latino and imagine that I'm on some sort of Spanish Mediterranean beach.
Donde está?
Yeah. My sweet La Vida. Which translates as my sweet The Life. So thanks for that one, Jerry.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you for the music, Jerry.
Thank you for the music, Jerry. Bye, boys. Bye.
Pocketbook Spanish.